administration, and in largely rehabilitating the Chinese economy, while at the same time undertaking a communist political and social revolution of vast proportions. The Chinese communists would not stop there. They wanted, the NSC asserted, to recapture the historically Chinese territories which the U.S. and the West now hold or protect, namely Taiwan and Hong Kong. They also wanted the eventual expulsion of Western or Western-allied forces from adjacent mainland areas, such as Indochina, Korea, and Malaya. And beyond that, they desired the substitution of Chinese communist influence for that of the West in the other areas of the Far East, especially Japan, Indonesia, and the Philippines. What should the United States do to halt China's march? The NSC ruled out war. That would lead to full U.S. mobilization, heavy casualties, the deployment of a major portion of U.S. armed forces to the China theater, possible use of a significant proportion of the U.S. atomic stockpile and employment of a major proportion of its atomic carriers, almost certainly a split of the U.S.-led coalition, and the probability of military intervention by the USSR, and a very high risk of global war. Eisenhower had just ended one war in Asia. He certainly did not seek another. Instead, the president preferred to combat communism in Asia using the same method that had worked effectively in Europe, containment. That meant generous economic and military aid to sympathetic governments in the region, along with close political, diplomatic, and personal ties, of the kind Nixon's trip sought to foster. This strategic concept aimed to avoid war, but it also required the United States to turn every outpost of Western influence into a symbol of American resolve. South Korea, Taiwan, French Indochina, British Malaya, the Philippines, and Japan all had to be defended from communist subversion. Ike's advisors now conceived of East Asia as a single zone of struggle against China and communism from which America could not retreat. Eisenhower's strategy of containment in Asia faced its first major test in Indochina in 1953-54, and the matter has been a subject of contentious debate among historians ever since. Searching for the long-term origins of America's tragic war in Vietnam, scholars return again and again to that tumultuous moment in the early 1950s, when the French Empire was collapsing and communism seemed poised for a stunning victory over the forces of Western colonialism. Eisenhower confronted a terrible dilemma. He could send U.S. military forces to prop up the rotten and unpopular French Empire, or he could stand aside as the communists seized northern Vietnam and took aim at the rest of Indochina. Most scholars have praised Eisenhower's wisdom and restraint as he worked through this awful problem. Despite considerable pressure from members of his cabinet, his leading military advisors, and the French government, Eisenhower did not commit American military forces to Indochina in 1954. Though willing to rattle his nuclear weapons at the Chinese to deter them from advancing into Vietnam, he shrewdly vetoed American military intervention, according to historian Robert Devine. Much later scholarship has sustained this argument. Yet the debate rages on. In his prize-winning study of the long-term origins of the Vietnam War, historian Frederick Logeval paints a less flattering portrait of the president. Stressing Eisenhower's adherence to the domino theory, Logeval argues that Eisenhower was fully prepared to intervene with force in order to halt the fall of Vietnam to the communists. What stopped him from doing so? Not his own innate caution, which Logeval dismisses. Instead, he was blocked by external forces, especially the reluctance of the U.S. Congress to give him a carte blanche for military intervention, as well as the opposition of America's crucial ally, Britain, to a wider war in Indochina. In this interpretation, it was the restraint of Congress, and especially the British government, not Eisenhower, that kept America out of war in Vietnam in 1954. The argument is difficult to resolve. Was Eisenhower a hawk or a dove? Does he deserve the praise he often receives for avoiding war in Vietnam, or was he truly spoiling for a fight, only to be hamstrung by Congress and his allies? As is typical with Eisenhower, the answer lies somewhere in between. There can be no doubt that he wanted to avoid an intervention by U.S. troops in Indochina. No more Koreas was his guiding dictum. Yet in pursuit of his overall strategic goal of containing China and halting the spread of communism, Eisenhower used every other tool at his disposal. He sent arms to fund the French war, spoke menacingly of falling dominoes, and pointedly issued nuclear threats to the Chinese to deter them from seizing Indochina as France withdrew. While his tactics worked in the short run to keep America out of another Asian war, Eisenhower nonetheless committed resources and prestige to Indochina in the cause of containment, and for that cause, just a decade later, Americans would fight and die. Eisenhower avoided war in 1954, but he also sowed many of the seeds that would yield the harvest of sorrow in later years. 2. A French colonial creation made up of three kingdoms, Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam. Indochina had been France's Asian jewel since the 1880s. Not only did the colony produce rice, rubber, tea and coffee, coal and zinc, but it demonstrated France's great power status. During the Second World War, the Japanese conquered Indochina, but in 1945, the French government set out to reclaim its colonial possession. It was not easy. France's plans were foiled by a powerful Vietnamese anti-colonial movement that had been much fortified during the war and was led by the well-educated and worldly communist Ho Chi Minh. In 1945, France began a military campaign to suppress the rebellion, inaugurating 30 years of bitter conflict in Vietnam. The French pursued a two-pronged strategy to defeat the communist insurgency, using French Foreign Legion and local Vietnamese soldiers supplemented by French regulars. They erected a protective cordon around population centers like Hanoi and Saigon and built static outposts in the countryside from which to launch raids into the hinterland. In addition, the French tried to create a plausible Vietnamese nationalist alternative to the charismatic Ho. They transformed Bao Dai, the pliant former emperor of Annam and the scion of the Nguyen dynasty, into a head of state, and they set up a national parliament to provide the illusion of local political autonomy. The strategy never worked. The communist Viet Minh used its control of the rural areas, especially in the northern province of Tonkin, to build popular support, resupply, strike at vulnerable French targets, and sap French morale. The Viet Minh also relied upon significant Chinese military aid. The French expeditionary force of about 75,000 soldiers, supplemented by 50,000 colonial troops from North and West Africa, and 300,000 Vietnamese, rarely took the initiative in the fighting and never inspired confidence among a population that was largely hostile to French rule. Without military success, the political strategy withered, since non-communist politicians perceived that Bao Dai did not have the leverage to deliver Vietnamese independence from France. The French could win neither on the battlefield nor in the hearts of the Vietnamese. Initially, American leaders looked warily at France's recolonization of Indochina, but with the triumph of Mao's communist revolution in 1949 and the outbreak of war in Korea just 8 months later, the Truman administration came to see French Indochina as a front in the global war against communism. By 1952, the United States was paying for at least half the cost of France's war there. Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles believed, as Dulles explained in a speech in early 1953, that the Soviets wanted to control Indochina, Siam, Burma, Malaya, what is called the Rice Bowl of Asia. Such control would allow them to threaten Japan and India. During the long discussions on board the USS Helena after Ike's Korean trip, cabinet officials agreed that Indochina must not fall to the communists. But how to avoid such a calamity. Upon taking office, Eisenhower and Dulles received dismal reports from the State Department and military officials who depicted the French war in Indochina as likely to end in a desultory defeat for France. The Joint Chiefs of Staff asserted that the communist Viet Minh held all the initiative in military matters, striking the French at will, and the French forces were too defensive-minded to achieve victory. In language that foreshadowed the grim American experience in Vietnam in the 1960s, one internal intelligence assessment put the issue bluntly. Although the French have been successful in inflicting severe losses on the Viet Minh and have considerably disrupted the Viet Minh economy, overall French operations cannot be considered successful because of their failure to arrive at a political solution that obtains the support or patriotism of the Vietnamese people. The picture was dark and getting worse. Such defeatist opinions did not satisfy the new team in Washington. The incoming chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Arthur Radford, thought he knew a great deal about Asia. Trained as a Navy pilot, he had led a carrier division in World War II, had sailed across every watery mile of the Pacific, and eventually commanded the entire Pacific Fleet. An ardent advocate, not surprisingly, of air and naval power, he was also an admirer of General MacArthur and a charter member of the Asia First Club that stressed the need to go on the offensive against communism in Asia. Radford considered the French poor soldiers, far too passive and defensive in their operations. Two good American divisions with a normal American aggressive spirit could clean up the situation in 10 months, he told the top State Department planners. The United States must use its leverage to force the French to adopt bolder tactics. It was essential, Radford felt, that we take a more hard-boiled attitude with the French in order to get them to adopt a more aggressive policy. This kind of can-do talk appealed to Eisenhower, who thought Indochina was of critical importance to the position of the free world in Asia. In March 1953, in a private discussion, Ike and his Secretary of State agreed that Indochina was the top priority in foreign policy, being in some ways more important than Korea because the consequences of a loss there could not be localized, but would spread throughout Asia and Europe. But merely stating Indochina's importance did not constitute a strategy for saving it. In late May, a worried U.S. embassy in Saigon reported to the State Department, despite continuing effort of 7 years and material increase in Vietnamese native armed forces, successful termination of war against communist arms is still as far from sight as ever. In the meantime, public opinion in France was turning ever more sharply against the war, as the moderate center-left newspapers Le Monde and L'Express called for a negotiated settlement and withdrawal. The maverick politician Pierre Mendès-France, a brilliant lawyer who led the radical socialist faction in Parliament, a center-left party despite its name, openly championed an immediate negotiated end to the war. On May 29, 1953, he came within a whisker of winning enough votes in the National Assembly to form a government and take the reins of power. Clearly, time was running out on the French war effort. It may seem paradoxical that at the very moment of his most successful foreign policy achievement, the July 1953 armistice in Korea, Eisenhower expanded America's commitment to the French war in Indochina. Yet, in fact, these two lines of policy were closely linked. Though hailed by most of the American public, Eisenhower's decision to accept an armistice in Korea prompted much gnashing of teeth among the hawkish Asia First faction of the Republican Party. To them, the deal to cease fighting in a divided Korea looked too much like Yalta, where FDR acquiesced in the Soviet conquest of Eastern Europe. During the 1952 campaign, the Republican right wing had been told by Foster Dulles that they could expect rollback and victory, not compromise and containment. Although they could hardly bay for more war after 3 years of bloody stalemate in Korea, the GOP hardliners did not like Ike's decision to stop the war short of victory. As the Los Angeles Times put it, The old guard is miserable about what's happened at Panmunjom, where the Korean armistice was signed. In order to shore up his right flank, Ike would have to show firmness in his policies toward Indochina, lest he ignite a full-scale rebellion in his party over his Asia policy. Having settled for stalemate in Korea, Eisenhower now looked to Indochina for an outright victory to balance the ledger. In return for more aid to France, America demanded battlefield results against the Viet Minh. To meet this pressure, the French leadership unveiled a new commander of the Indochina war effort in May 1953. General Henri Navarre, a soldier with a distinguished battle record earned in both world wars in the Near East and North Africa, went to Vietnam determined to succeed where his predecessors had failed. He had never been to Indochina, but he believed he could turn the tide of war. Navarre proposed a more aggressive strategy: build up the Vietnamese army, send more mobile groups of elite French troops into the north to do the heavy fighting, and secure more air and sea lift capacity from the United States. All this, Navarre claimed, would bring a kind of victory in 2 years. Navarre's confidence and aplomb won the approval of the Americans, though his actual plan raised eyebrows among the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who remained skeptical about French fighting capabilities. Nonetheless, Navarre's plan was the only game in town, and the Americans embraced it. But there was a catch. It was going to cost more, much more, and America would have to pay. Congress approved a $400 million package of military aid in July 1953, but this was not enough to meet the needs of the Navarre plan. At the end of July, Prime Minister Joseph Laniel secretly approached the American ambassador in Paris, Douglas Dillon, and made a brazen demand. The French needed another $400 million to fund the Navarre plan. If Laniel did not get these extra funds, he could not commit to the more aggressive strategy, and his government would fall, thus leading the way to a peace-at-any-price government led by Mendes France. "If funds are not available to carry on in Indochina," Laniel told Dillon, "the only alternative is eventual withdrawal." Some might call it blackmail, but it was simply a statement of the truth. France could keep the war going only if the United States picked up the tab. And the American leadership accepted the arrangement. In a hastily written report to the National Security Council, the director of the State Department's policy planning staff, Robert Bowie, put the issue bluntly. The United States could grasp a promising opportunity to further a satisfactory conclusion of the war in Indochina by spending an additional $400 million, or it could accept the loss of Indochina and possibly other areas of Southeast Asia. Seen in those terms, the choice looked easy. On August 6, the NSC gave provisional approval for $385 million in increased aid. A few weeks later, Eisenhower formally signed off on the additional funds. Foster Dulles seemed to think it was a good deal. He told his colleagues on the NSC that Laniel and Navarre together promised a dynamic approach to the military problem in Indochina. If these additional funds would help push France into action, Dulles said, it would be the cheapest money we ever spent. But the Eisenhower administration was then wrangling with a painful budget-cutting exercise, and Ike had especially targeted the Defense Department for trimming. By providing a total of $785 million to France's war just in fiscal year 1954 alone, equivalent to $6.3 billion today, Ike made plain that the Indochina War stood at the very top of his list of national security priorities. Eisenhower publicly justified this largesse by invoking the specter of communist victory across Asia. In a speech on August 4th to the 45th Annual Governors' Conference in Seattle, he told his audience why he was so concerned with Indochina. "If Indochina goes, several things happen right away," he claimed. "India would be outflanked, and Burma would be in no position for defense. How would the free world hold the rich empire of Indonesia? So you see, somewhere along the line, this must be blocked, and it must be blocked now. And that's what we are trying to do. So when the United States votes $400 million to help that war, we are not voting a giveaway program. We are voting for the cheapest way we can prevent the occurrence of something that would be of a most terrible significance to the United States of America. Like Dulles, Eisenhower argued that money spent on the French war was money well spent. In addition to increasing aid to the French, Eisenhower and Dulles decided to put the Chinese on notice that America's determination to hold the line in Asia was undiminished. Dulles took to the airwaves on September 2nd to deliver a threat, carefully vetted by Ike, that if China took advantage of the Korean armistice to shift soldiers and resources to the war in Vietnam, the United States would immediately intensify its own military commitments there. If America was drawn into war in Indochina through Chinese provocation, Dulles asserted, the resulting conflict might not be confined to Indochina. Hinting at a possible nuclear war against China had become the signature Dulles style, no less hair-raising for all its familiarity. The weak link in all of this was, of course, France. For if the French should falter in their commitment to the war, then America might well have to send in its own troops to rescue Southeast Asia, a prospect Eisenhower strongly opposed. So Eisenhower placed his bets and his nation's prestige on the outcome of a war fought in tropical jungles by a beleaguered French colonial expeditionary force against a well-armed and ideologically motivated National Liberation Army. It was a colossal gamble. And for once, Eisenhower's usual luck at games of chance failed him. 3. In late November 1953, as part of General Navarre's new aggressive strategy, the French sent an airborne force to seize a small outpost in Tonkin on the Laotian border, a hitherto insignificant crossroads called Dien Bien Phu. Navarre planned to build a powerful base from which to defend Laos and also stage offensive strikes against the Viet Minh. American analysts were unimpressed by this strategy, seeing it as too passive. In truth, the CIA believed the French were not trying to win the war in Indochina at all. They simply wanted to improve their position sufficiently to negotiate a settlement which would eliminate the drain of the Indochina war on France. Nixon, freshly returned from his extensive Asia journey, confirmed this gloomy picture in a detailed report to the President and the National Security Council on the day before Christmas, 1953. His diagnosis confirmed what observers in Indochina had been saying for years. France had not given the Vietnamese people anything to fight for. The French had failed to build a serious Vietnamese army to share the burden of fighting and refused to offer Vietnam full independence. As a result, nationalist leaders declined to work with French authorities. Bao Dai was widely seen as a puppet who lacked legitimacy. Vietnam had no powerful figure like Korea's Syng Man Rhee, who could rally the nation to fight the communist foe. Even Nixon, who always tried to align himself with what Eisenhower wanted to hear, could not pretty up the picture. The communists have a sense of history, he said, and time is on their side. At the start of 1954, Eisenhower held a number of crucial high-level meetings with his advisers to determine how the United States would react if France should suddenly lose its will to sustain the fight in Indochina. Should America fight for Indochina if France would not? The question could no longer be ignored. In the National Security Council meeting of January 8th, when his advisers discussed the possible need for the United States to intervene in order to prop up the French war effort, Eisenhower spoke decisively. The minutes record his adamant opposition to sending American soldiers to Indochina. He simply could not imagine the United States putting ground forces anywhere in Southeast Asia. There was just no sense in even talking about United States forces replacing the French in Indochina. If we did so, the Vietnamese could be expected to transfer their hatred of the French to us. I cannot tell you, said the president with vehemence, how bitterly opposed I am to such a course of action. This war in Indochina would absorb our troops by divisions. Indeed, the U.S. Army had already run the numbers and concluded it would take 7 Army divisions and 1 Marine division to defeat the Viet Minh. Along with support and logistics personnel, that meant sending 275,000 men to Indochina, just months after halting a most unpopular war in Korea. Eisenhower clearly had no appetite for such a dramatic move. Having taken direct combat intervention off the table, however, Ike still had a number of measures open to him. When Admiral Radford suggested that American planes be used to help break the alarmingly large Viet Minh buildup around Dien Bien Phu, Eisenhower warmed to the idea and mused that non-American pilots might be allowed to fly U.S. planes without insignia. This action could be done without involving us directly in the war, which he admitted would be a very dangerous thing. Secretary of the Treasury George Humphrey, who loudly opposed such a step-by-step increase of direct military help, put the issue bluntly to Ike. Suppose the French were to give up and turn the whole country over to the communists. Would the United States then interfere? Eisenhower confirmed his position, saying, No, we would not intervene. Offering aircraft and pilots to the French, however, was like sticking your finger in a leaky dike. And with leaky dikes, it's sometimes better to put a finger in than to let the whole structure be washed away. The NSC therefore ordered that 40 B-26 bombers and 200 U.S. technicians be dispatched to Indochina. Just this small gesture, sending Americans into a combat zone, proved controversial. But Eisenhower told congressional leaders that this small project of a few hundred technical personnel would achieve a very large purpose, that is, to prevent all of Southeast Asia from falling to the communists. In his public press conference on February 10th, he stressed that he wanted to keep France in the war so Americans could stay out. No one could be more bitterly opposed to ever getting the U.S. involved in a hot war in that region than I am, Eisenhower declared in front of a room full of reporters. Every move I authorize is calculated to make certain that that does not happen. This became the leitmotif of Ike's Asian diplomacy. To maneuver in such a way that the war could be sustained without direct U.S. involvement. For emphasis, he insisted, I cannot conceive of a greater tragedy for America than to get heavily involved now in an all-out war in any part of those regions. With public statements about the tragedy of war in Indochina clattering across the wire services, the French could be excused for trying to bring their part in the conflict to a close. In February, the French government, desperate to appease a restive and war-weary public, successfully managed to secure the agreement of the great powers to include discussion of the Indochina war at a summit in Geneva in late April. The purpose of the meeting, initially proposed by the Soviets, was to discuss an easing of tensions in Korea, where the armistice remained fragile and unsteady. But Foreign Minister Georges Bidault, under express orders from Paris, asked the 5 powers, the USSR, the United States, Britain, France, and Communist China, to take up the possibility of a compromise settlement in Indochina. U.S. policy had been opposed to any such talks for months, especially in the presence of the Communist Chinese, whom the U.S. government did not recognize as legitimate representatives of the Chinese people. The United States recognized nationalist China, or Taiwan, as the only legitimate Chinese government. Yet Bidault insisted that if the issue was not placed on the Geneva agenda, the Laniel government would be voted out of office, and an anti-war government would be installed. The United States had to accept placing Indochina on the agenda at Geneva as the price of keeping the war going. By circling a date on the calendar for a great power summit to discuss the future of Indochina, France motivated the Viet Minh to improve their bargaining position by winning a big battle in the weeks before the conference. And a large target had conveniently presented itself the heavily fortified and now surrounded French garrison at Dien Bien Phu. By February, Navarre had transferred 15,000 elite French soldiers there. Engineers refitted and expanded a small airfield to allow DC-3 aircraft to bring in light tanks, howitzers, and plenty of ammunition. Navarre's initial purpose was to use this strong point as a base and to sally forth from this heavy redoubt to block Viet Minh forays into Laos. The French military leadership expressed confidence in its ability to fend off the Viet Minh attacks. Indeed, they seemed almost to welcome a showdown as an opportunity to draw Viet Minh forces into a large engagement in which heavy French firepower would take a murderous toll on the enemy. Welcome or not, the attack came. On March 13, 1954, thousands of Viet Minh soldiers threw themselves at the heavily defended outpost under cover of a ferocious artillery barrage. The Battle of Dien Bien Phu had begun. 4. The next 8 weeks marked an anxious, stress-filled period for Eisenhower, among the most complicated and controversial days of his presidency. France teetered on the brink of collapse in Indochina, and Eisenhower had to decide, would the United States, which had fought to save South Korea from communism, now bail out the French in Vietnam? As the first news reports about Dien Bien Phu reached Washington, American officials did not panic. To be sure, the U.S. ambassador in Saigon, Donald Heath, reported that the opening phase of the battle gives cause for some concern. Viet Minh artillery is zeroed in on French positions. Both airstrips, in consequence, are unusable. Right from the start of the battle, the French had to rely on airdrops for their daily supplies of food and ammunition. Even so, CIA Director Alan Dulles reported to the NSC on March 18th that the chances for a French victory stood at 50-50. Not great odds, but not desperate either. Viet Minh forces were taking huge casualties. Eisenhower took some comfort from the fact that the French were fighting from prepared and heavily fortified positions. Alan Dulles even went so far as to suggest that the French in Saigon might be playing up the gravity of the crisis so as to exaggerate the extent of their final victory. And Navarre confided to Ambassador Heath that even if the Viet Minh should take the besieged garrison, his capacity to remain in the Indochina war would not be greatly impaired. Another French emissary delivered the same message of sang-froid. On March 20th, General Paul Elie, chief of staff of the French Armed Forces, arrived in Washington for a week of discussions with the Eisenhower administration. Elie had served as French representative to the NATO Council and knew his American counterparts well. Radford welcomed him and took him to dine with leading members of the government, including Nixon, Alan Dulles, and the Army's Chief of Staff, General Matthew Ridgway. Elie, a tall, wiry veteran of both world wars, lauded the stalwart determination of the Lanyel government to carry on the war in Indochina and stated that newspaper reports, especially the left-wing French press, exaggerate in some degree the defeatist sentiment in France. He acknowledged the enormous political significance of Dien Bien Phu. A communist victory there would amplify calls in France for a negotiated end to the fighting, but he felt reasonably confident that France could hang on, provided that the United States would send more combat aircraft for use in the battle. Elie did not sound especially worried. Indeed, Elie's demeanor struck Radford as far too calm. In Radford's view, the situation at Dien Bien Phu and in Indochina generally looked catastrophic, and Radford clearly wanted Elie to make bigger demands on Washington while offering to share direction of the war effort. Radford believed that American air power could save Dien Bien Phu and perhaps crush the Viet Minh altogether. On March 26th, in a remarkable act that approached the boundaries of insubordination, Radford tried to get the French general to make a direct appeal to Eisenhower for American military intervention at Dien Bien Phu. Elie was wary, but Radford egged him on, telling him privately that if France would only ask for it, the United States would deliver massive air support to the embattled French outpost. Surprised, Elie reported Radford's zeal to Paris, where this remarkable offer was duly noted and filed away for future use. While Radford was proffering airstrikes to the French, however, Eisenhower, on March 24th, repeated his opposition to a wider U.S. role. "We should not get involved in fighting in Indochina unless there were the political preconditions necessary for a successful outcome," he told Foster Dulles. "Those preconditions, such as immediate independence for the Indochinese states, full international approval for any military action, and a Vietnamese request for American intervention, were highly unlikely to be in place soon, as Ike knew." Dulles noted for the record that Eisenhower did not wholly exclude the possibility of a single strike against the Viet Minh at Dien Bien Phu, if it were almost certain this would produce decisive results. But Eisenhower knew better than anyone that a single airstrike would not dislodge three full divisions of Viet Minh soldiers from their positions around Dien Bien Phu. And in fact, the French were already bombing the Viet Minh positions with napalm and thousand-pound bombs. Ike knew there was no easy way to break the Viet Minh troops, and he did not want Americans tangled up in a jungle war they could not win. On March 25th, when the president met with his National Security Council, Allen Dulles reported that Dien Bien Phu was relatively quiet and that the French position had improved somewhat. The French seemed to be holding their own. Foster Dulles asked the group to take up the question of just how far the United States was willing to go to help the French in the event of their withdrawal from Indochina. Eisenhower asserted that any U.S. role would require the approval of the United Nations, as well as an invitation from the government of Vietnam itself. It would also require the approval of Congress. "It was simply academic to imagine otherwise," he said. Since the likelihood of securing UN, Vietnamese, and congressional approval for American military action in Indochina was nil, Eisenhower was indirectly vetoing intervention. Instead, he began to outline what he considered a more constructive path: the creation of a group of governments and nations who might be approached to assist in securing Indochina. Nations such as Australia, New Zealand, the Philippines, Britain, France, and other free Southeast Asian countries. Might there be a place for some kind of Asian collective security organization that could backstop the French in Indochina? As the former commander of NATO, Eisenhower could easily see that model applied in Asia. In fact, Eisenhower had been thinking about this idea for some time. In mid-January 1954, he had asked a small group of his most trusted advisors, chaired by Undersecretary of State Beadle Smith, to think broadly about a Southeast Asia area plan, as he called it, including the possible alternative lines of action to be taken in case of a reverse in Indochina. In mid-February, while testifying to a closed executive session of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Smith revealed that planning along those lines had moved ahead. Rejecting the domino theory, Smith said, "Even at the worst, part of Indochina might be lost without losing the rest of Southeast Asia. One can think of the possibility of an area defense pact which might include Thailand as the bastion, Burma and possibly Cambodia and part of Indochina, and maybe some part of it could be lost without disastrous effect." A man as savvy as Smith, Ike's intimate confidant, would never have said such things unless they squared with the president's thinking. When Senator William Langer asked Smith whether the United States would go ahead alone if France quits on us, Smith replied curtly, "I do not think so, sir." "No." No unilateral U.S. intervention then, but a regional confederation of allied states operating perhaps with the blessing of the United Nations and in concert with free governments to haul communist aggression. This tantalizing vision took hold in Eisenhower's administration. On March 29th, Foster Dulles gave a speech at the Overseas Press Club in New York that explained this new policy. The speech had been, as usual, carefully edited by Eisenhower. It called for united action against the military interference of China in the affairs of the Vietnamese people and against the ideological imperialism directed from Beijing and Moscow. Dulles spelled out an indictment of the Chinese for aiding the Viet Minh insurrection and declared that Communist China had placed all of Southeast Asia in jeopardy. Indochina was in the crosshairs now, but if it fell, the rest of Southeast Asia would soon be targeted. China's subversive tactics constituted a grave threat to the whole free community and had to be stopped. Though full of ominous hints and hawkish bluster, Dulles did not specify what he meant by united action, and historians to this day disagree on how to interpret his speech. Perhaps his obfuscation was deliberate, designed to keep the Chinese guessing. Or perhaps his policy remained in flux and his speech aimed to hide the confusion inside the administration. In his weekly news conference 2 days later, Eisenhower distanced himself somewhat from Dulles's bellicose remarks. Asked by Martin Nagransky of ABC if he was considering direct military intervention, Ike hedged. "I can conceive of no greater disadvantage to America than to be employing its own ground forces and any other kind of forces in great numbers around the world, meeting each little situation as it arises." That statement did not rule out the use of force, but it sounded less hawkish than Dulles's remarks. "What we are trying to do," the president went on, "is to make our friends strong enough to take care of local situations by themselves, with the financial, the moral, the political, and certainly, only where our own vital interests demanded any military help." Eisenhower, it seems, viewed the united action concept not as an Allied invasion force, but as a symbolic assertion of common purpose by the Western and democratic nations to halt communist expansion. United action was a shield rather than a sword. Dulles's speech aimed to make the Chinese think twice about extending their reach into Indochina, and to show the French that the world would not abandon them in their hour of need. Though bellicose, the speech was, in fact, a mask of angry words crafted to hide Eisenhower's deep reluctance to enter another Asian war. 5. Eisenhower, a lifelong student of strategy, knew that deterrence could succeed in keeping the peace only if it was backed by a willingness to use force. He wanted to keep America out of war, but perhaps the best way to do that was to prepare for it. That meant sounding out Congress. On April 1, 1954, shortly after a meeting of his National Security Council, Eisenhower tasked the Secretary of State to consult congressional leaders. How much appetite did they have for conflict in Southeast Asia? Would they support the use of American forces there? If I could tell the world that Congress had approved a resolution giving him the authority to use air and naval power to help the French, China could only conclude that America was truly girding itself for confrontation. Dulles drafted a congressional resolution and reviewed it with Eisenhower in a meeting on April 2nd. Which Radford and Defense Secretary Charles Wilson also attended. The resolution asked Congress to give the President authority to employ naval and air power to assist the forces which are resisting aggression in Southeast Asia. Was this a request for a blank check to begin a war in Vietnam? That is not how Ike and Dulles saw it. Dulles expressly told Eisenhower that the resolution was designed to be a deterrent, and to make the call for united action among the Allies seemed more credible. Backing Radford into a corner, Dulles insisted that he did not see the resolution as the preliminary step to a military strike. Wilson agreed, and characterized the resolution as an effort to fill our hand, so that we would be in a stronger position to negotiate with the states that would join the new Asian Security Group. The proposed resolution would give Eisenhower the appearance of a man preparing his nation for war precisely so he could more effectively avoid it. On Saturday, April 3rd at 9:30 a.m., Dulles and Radford held a meeting at the State Department with a number of congressional leaders from both parties. Senate Majority Leader William Noland, Senator Eugene Milliken, and Speaker of the House Joseph Martin represented the Republicans. Democratic Senators Lyndon Johnson, Minority Leader Richard Russell, and Minority Whip Earl C. Clements were joined by Democratic Representatives John McCormick, the Minority Whip, and J. Percy Priest, the Chief Deputy Whip. Dulles did not present them with the text of the draft resolution he had given Eisenhower. Instead, according to the summary of the meeting Dulles wrote afterward, he and Radford summarized the administration's well-known view that Indochina possessed extraordinary geopolitical significance, and its loss to communism would threaten vital American interests in Southeast Asia. Dulles expressed his belief that in light of the high-stakes battle now being waged there, the president should have congressional backing so that he could use air and sea power in the area if he felt it necessary in the interest of national security. It was a clumsy overture. The congressional leaders sniffed out Dulles's encroachment on their constitutional prerogative to declare war. Other than Noland, an eager Asia firster, the legislators demurred. They worried that Eisenhower, if granted such powers, might take actions that could trigger war. "We want no more Koreas," they said. And in this they surely spoke for the great majority of Americans. Dulles and Radford insisted that the administration did not now contemplate the commitment of land forces. But the distinction between land and air forces did not assuage congressional concerns. The congressman made the argument that once the flag was committed, whether attached to a plane or a naval vessel, the use of land forces would inevitably follow. Yet for all their caution, the congressman did not flatly reject Dulles's request. Instead, they asked for a demonstration that America's allies, especially Britain, supported the concept of united action and were ready to help create a coalition of nations to come to the aid of French Indochina. If such a public statement of support from allies could be secured, then a congressional resolution could be passed. Later writers invested this meeting with enormous and probably exaggerated significance. It became immortalized as "the day we didn't go to war," after one of the men present, Congressman McCormick, leaked the content of the discussion to Washington Post reporter Chalmers Roberts. In McCormick's telling, Dulles's request for a congressional resolution as part of a policy of deterrence was overshadowed by Radford's hair-raising briefing, in which he laid out a plan for immediate airstrikes on Dien Bien Phu by carrier-based jets in the South China Sea. McCormick turned the encounter into an epic standoff. Radford seemed bent on starting a war, and the Democrats in the room rose to quash the idea. But Dulles did not think the congressman had stymied the administration at all. Right after the meeting ended, Dulles called President Eisenhower, who was spending the weekend at Camp David. Dulles was ambiguous at first, saying the meeting went pretty well, although it raised some serious problems. He did not specify what those problems were. He told Ike that he thought Congress would be quite prepared to go along on some vigorous action if we were not doing it alone. Eisenhower thought such a position was reasonable. Indeed, his entire policy depended upon mobilizing allied nations to come to Indochina's defense. That meant Eisenhower and Dulles needed Britain to sign on to united action. And fast. 6. To win the support of the British government, Eisenhower dipped into his deep reservoir of personal friendship with Winston Churchill. Just before midnight on April 4, 1954, the president sent a powerful and quite unprecedented telegram to his old comrade in arms. Drafted by Eisenhower, Dulles, and Counselor of the State Department Douglas MacArthur II, the message sought to appeal to the Prime Minister's well-known romantic streak by depicting April 1954 as a moment of world historical importance akin to the early days of the war against Hitler. France was faltering before the onslaught of Chinese-backed aggression. The fall of Indochina would have a disastrous effect on the global strategic position of the United States and Britain. How could such an outcome be avoided? Eisenhower proposed to Churchill the Allied coalition concept that he and Dulles had discussed, namely, a new ad hoc grouping or coalition composed of nations which have a vital concern in the checking of communist expansion in the area. The important thing is that the coalition must be strong, and it must be willing to join the fight if necessary. I do not envision the need of any appreciable ground forces on your part or our part. If the members of the alliance are sufficiently resolute, it should be able to make clear to the Chinese communists that the continuation of their material support to the Viet Minh will inevitably lead to the growing power of the forces arrayed against them. This was the crucial element of the concept. Action now by the free powers would compel the Chinese to back off, withdraw their support for the Viet Minh, and cease their inexorable drive into Southeast Asia. Deterrence required credibility. That is what Ike wanted Churchill to give him. By creating a powerful coalition, Eisenhower asserted, "We will enormously increase our chances of bringing the Chinese to believe that their interests lie in the direction of a discreet disengagement." Ike's bid for Churchill's support was no battle cry. On the contrary, it was a means to deter the Chinese, buck up the French, and keep the dogs of war on a tight leash. Eisenhower's telegram ended with an egregious and somewhat embarrassing invocation of the dark days of 1938 and 39, when Britain, against Churchill's advice, preferred to appease rather than confront Hitler. "We failed to stop Hirohito, Mussolini, and Hitler by not acting in unity and in time. May it not be thought that our nations have learned something from that lesson?" To lecture Churchill, whose country fought Hitler for 2 years before the United States entered war, on the appropriate lessons of history was a shocking act of bad taste. But this reference to appeasement reinforced the basic logic of Eisenhower's policy. In 1938, at Munich, the Allies appeased Hitler and war followed. Now, in 1954, the Allies must stand together and act firmly in the face of aggression, so that war could be avoided. Eisenhower's strategy of deterrence encountered some unexpected trouble late in the evening of April 4th. At about 9:45 p.m., the State Department received a cable from Ambassador Douglas Dillon in Paris, reporting that he had been summoned by Prime Minister Laniel and Foreign Minister Bidault. "They said," Dillon wrote, "that immediate armed intervention of U.S. carrier aircraft at Dien Bien Phu is now necessary to save the situation. The Viet Minh were bringing in massive reinforcements and the garrison was in grave jeopardy. The French government was seeking to cash in the chip that Radford had slipped into General Ely's pocket on March 26th, a promise to bring American aircraft into battle should France request such aid." Bidault told Dillon that, "for good or evil, the fate of Southeast Asia now rested on Dien Bien Phu." Early on April 5th, Secretary Dulles called the president and told him about Dillon's cable. Ike was furious. Radford should never have told a foreign country he would do his best to get the president's approval for intervention, because they then start putting pressure on us. Dulles tried to protect Radford from Ike's wrath, blaming Ely for the misunderstanding. "Radford did not give any committal talk," Dulles said, untruthfully. Eisenhower rejected the idea of intervention out of hand. "It would be completely unconstitutional and indefensible. We cannot engage in active war. Any military act required congressional approval, the support of allies, and much greater preparation, so it could be part of an overall strategy. Piecemeal airstrikes would jeopardize American prestige, anger Congress, and quite possibly draw a Chinese military intervention in response. In short, bombing Dien Bien Phu was about the worst thing I could imagine." Within the hour, Dulles cabled a reply to Ambassador Dillon, rejecting the French request. With all these elements of a complex story swirling around, Dulles's United Action speech on March 29th, the meeting with congressional leaders on April 3rd, the Churchill telegram, and the appeal from the French on April 4th, Ike moved up the usual weekly meeting of the National Security Council from Thursday to Tuesday, April 6th. The discussion again took up the question of military intervention by U.S. and allied forces in Indochina. Alan Dulles weighed in, noting that if the United States were to intervene strongly enough to bring about the defeat of the Viet Minh, there was a very great danger of the Chinese pouring across the border into Indochina, just as they had done in Korea in November 1950. CIA intelligence counted 5 divisions of Chinese soldiers 200 miles from Dien Bien Phu, just across the Vietnamese border, and an additional 200,000 men within 300 miles of the border. An American intervention would provide justification for these troops to sweep down into Vietnam. These chilling facts may explain the lack of enthusiasm at the April 6th meeting for military intervention. Eisenhower set the tone, speaking with great emphasis. According to the note taker, he said, "There was no possibility whatever of U.S. unilateral intervention in Indochina, and we had best face that fact." Following Eisenhower's lead, Foster Dulles now asserted that the NSC did not need to consider a military option at the present time, however desperate the situation at Dien Bien Phu. Instead, America must concentrate on an effort to build up strength in the Southeast Asia area to such a point that military intervention might prove unnecessary. If he could win the support of other allied nations to form a united bloc, the communists might well give up their intent to seize the area. Over the course of a long discussion, Radford, Nixon, and even Foster Dulles tried to keep open the option of using military force as a last resort if united action failed. But Ike seemed to have made up his mind against it. He instead expressed warm approval for the idea of a political organization which would have for its purpose the defense of Southeast Asia, even if Indochina should be lost. In any case, the creation of such a political organization for defense would be better than emergency military action. Eisenhower would not go to war to save French Indochina, but he would gladly lead a collective security organization in Asia that would bolster the free nations, draw a line in the sand, and dare the Chinese to cross it. 7. The president had made his decision. He would not send Americans to fight in Vietnam. He told his advisers confidentially that he rejected the simplistic idea that because we might lose Indochina, we would necessarily have to lose all the rest of Southeast Asia. Privately, he argued that the domino theory should not force America's hand. It was possible, he believed, to create a strong Western position in Asia, even without Indochina. But in public, Eisenhower delivered a very different message. Just a day after telling the NSC that there was no possibility whatever of U.S. unilateral intervention in Indochina, he strode into the Indian Treaty Room in the old Executive Office Building for his usual weekly press conference. When journalist Robert Richards of the Copley Press asked the president to comment on the strategic importance of Indochina, Eisenhower became expansive and, in some of his most famous words, asserted the viability of the domino theory. First of all, you have the specific value of a locality in its production of materials that the world needs, he began. Then you have the possibility that many human beings pass under a dictatorship that is inimical to the free world. Finally, you have broader considerations that might follow what you would call the falling domino principle. You have a row of dominoes set up. You knock over the first one, and what will happen to the last one is the certainty that it will go over very quickly. He went on to prophesy a total disaster in Asia if Indochina fell. The possible consequences of the loss are just incalculable to the free world, he concluded darkly. No wonder his contemporaries were baffled by Eisenhower's strategy toward Asia. While pursuing a policy of restraint and diplomacy, he publicly warned against the catastrophic consequences of communist success and hinted at the most severe American response to any direct challenge. The consequences of such double talk were serious. When Foster Dulles arrived in London on April 11th to confer with his British counterparts to try to win their support for the Allied coalition to support the French, He found the British both dubious about American objectives and deeply anxious about Eisenhower's warlike words. Churchill and Foreign Minister Eden, longtime friends and partners of the Eisenhower team, fretted about Eisenhower's nuclear saber-rattling. Just a month earlier, the United States had tested the world's largest